Hey, good morning, everybody. 2 days, folks. A workable weekend. A weekend we can go outside and enjoy and get work done and just have a good time. But these may be, maybe these are the last two hot and nasties. It's going to be humid, going to be pretty warm for this time of the year, but it should be over. We should be on that break and be enjoying the cooler weather, the low temperatures at night. The fall season of growing is here, and we should be out there enjoying it. It's going to be a lovely week, but pay attention. We're not looking at rain. Some of us got plenty, and that's great, but don't assume that somehow we roll into fall and we don't have to water anymore, because we still do. Fortunately, we may not have to water as much because water doesn't evaporate and the stress isn't on the plants. But don't just arbitrarily go, it's fall, we don't water. We're going to go at least a full week, and it's been a couple days now already where we haven't gotten any rain. So still keep an eye on your plants, especially in your garden. Remember, cucumbers, lettuce, spinach, they can bolt, not just because of the temperature, but stresses from not enough water, and that can be really bad. So don't just turn the valve off. Make sure you're going out and check. Let's go to the phone. This is Mike. Good morning, Mike. What can I help you with?
Good morning, Jeff. I have tomato plants that are enormous and sprawling, and with sprawling on the ground, branches on the ground. Would it do any good to cut off some of the sprawl, with particular reference to the part that's on the ground?
Yes, it can make a benefit for you. Whenever a tomato touches the soil, it's going to try to set roots. Now, that means it's focusing its energy on doing something other than making tomatoes for you. So as you're cutting some of this back, first, look at the branch and make sure there's no flower blossoms on it. It's not already trying to put fruit on that particular branch. If there are no flower buds there, go ahead and cut that back. And you can start shaping it down a little bit. There's plenty of time for it to put on new growth. It's probably got plenty of roots. But stuff hanging on the ground is going to try to become a new plant. And that means it's not focusing on doing what you want it to do, and that's make tomatoes. So don't cut off any tomato blossoms, but feel free to cut off some of that extra leafy part of the plant that you don't need, and especially look at the part that may be laying on the ground. If you can remove it, do so.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Tomatoes are a plant that does what's called adventitious rooting. It's a really fancy term that says any part of the stem can touch the soil and suddenly decide to set roots into the soil. In certain cases, that's a real advantage, like when we talk about our squashes, the vining squashes like butternut. As that vine touches the ground, it'll set more roots. That can be a defense and help survive squash vine borer. With tomatoes, it can be an advantage for you as a home gardener because it means you can cut off a shoot of a particularly productive tomato, start it in a 4-inch pot, and you can do your own cloning. You can start a whole new tomato from just a 6 to 8 inch piece of cutting off of a plant you already have. But when it hits the ground, and your goal is that the tomato's producing tomatoes, right? When it hits the ground and it starts going, oh, I'm going to put on new roots, it's not actually putting on new roots and going, look, my tomato's going to have all this extra energy. No, it's having to put the energy into making the roots instead of making the flowers, making those tomatoes for you. This is one of the reasons we cage tomatoes. Keeping them up off of the ground, well, it keeps the fruit from rotting. It keeps insects away. But it also focuses the energy of the plant on this upright growth to produce flowers and fruit for you. And you're getting the most out of the tomatoes. If your tomatoes are falling over like that, yeah, go ahead and trim them. If you have a caged tomato, my tomato cages go like 6 or 7 foot tall. If you have tomato that's exceeding that, if you have tomato in a cage and it's doubled over and this and that, it's okay to trim them back. Now, I'm not a big advocate of going in there and pinching off all those starts that come in between the branch and the leaf, you know, and, you know, thinning out the tomato like that. I don't make that kind of effort. But if you've got a lot of growth that, well, there's no blossoms on it and it's just getting in the way and it's almost touching the ground, yeah, go ahead and trim up that tomato. It lets it focus on what it's supposed to do, making fruit. So keep an eye on that. There was I heard on Cheryl's show a call about nutrients for plants. The hydroponic world can have some advantages over the soil world, because in the hydroponic world, some of the nutrients that are needed for the plants can be made in forms that are readily available to the plant that are not necessarily readily available in the soil growing version. And we have to rely on a really good soil biology to break things down and provide the nutrients. There's pros and cons here. I'm not saying one's better than the other. But there was a comment about something called CalMag, a calcium-magnesium blend. Before you go out and just start throwing stuff in the soil, the idea that tomatoes need a ready supply of calcium so they don't get blossom end rot, that statement tends to be a fact. But that doesn't mean you turn around and go, I need to add calcium to the soil. Why? Did you test your soil first? Do you have a problem with blossom end rot? Make sure that as you are adding things that you need the benefit that they'll provide. Sometimes some of these extra nutrients in too high a quantity cancel out other nutrients. So you can also reach levels where too much of a good thing is toxic. It is relatively inexpensive. It is not something you need to do every single season. But contacting us and sending a sample to a quality soil lab, a great one here in Texas is Texas Plant and Soil Lab. Texas Plant and Soil Lab. You can Google that. They do an excellent test that is really good to tell you not what's in the soil, but what's available to the plant. And if you find you already have a great calcium magnesium balance and everything is good there, why are you adding more? You can actually push other nutrients out of balance and you've created a worse problem than you've solved. So consider before you just start diving in with bags of stuff, consider first getting a decent soil test. It gives you a roadmap of where to go. Folks, this is Gardening Naturally. Virginia, Carl, I see you there. Can you hang on? We're going to take a quick break. Welcome back, everybody. Let's just continue to the phone. This is Virginia. Good morning, Virginia. What can I help you with?
Good morning. Good morning. Hello?
Okay. Yes, ma'am. What can I help you with?
Well, I have a large, huge, very large magnolia tree, and I just recently noticed that there was some moss balls on them, on the limbs, and I want to make sure that I shouldn't be concerned, or should I be concerned to have them removed or do something about it?
A little bit of both. The moss balls that are on the tree are simply passengers. They take nothing out of the tree. They only hang on to the tree to grow there. So they're not hurting the tree. But when they start to show up, they're kind of telling you, your tree could be happier. They tend to show up when the canopy isn't as dense as it may need to be. When you get some sunlight can start trickling into the inside of the tree, because those moss balls wouldn't grow there if they weren't getting sun. And inside the canopy of a tree, they really shouldn't be getting a lot of sun there. So do you need to take them off? No, they will not hurt the tree. If you don't like how they look, it's okay if you want to knock them out of there. They will just knock off the tree really easy. If you can reach them with a big long stick, you can just use that to knock them off of there. But you should start looking at the tree and make sure the tree's really happy. Did you make sure it got water when it needed it this year? Have you put compost down around the roots of the tree in the last year? Maybe, especially because it's a magnolia, they can have some problems here in Central Texas. There's a product called Copperus, C-O-P-P-E-R-U-S, I believe.
Okay.
It's a safe product. It's very easy to apply. A little goes a long way, and maybe twice a year, I might sprinkle some of that around the root zone of the plant. Magnolias have a little problem getting iron out of our soil, and that product can help out a little bit and keep them looking good.
Okay.
But proper water, compost once a year around the root zone, maybe the copperas, and I think that you'll keep the tree happy, meaning it'll put on more leaves and it will block the sun so you won't be getting those balls growing in the tree itself. They're not hurting it, but they're telling you that the tree could be happier.
Okay. Now, I do know, just like you're saying, I do notice the limbs that are exposed to the sun are where the moss balls are.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't trim the tree because it's just so beautiful, but I just wanted to let you also know that I have some crepe myrtles on the opposite side of the yard from the tree. And then I have a white one, and then there's the red ones. But the white one, when I first put it in the yard, it had some moss balls, and that little tree never thrived. And at some point, I thought it was just going to die. But I kept knocking those balls off, and it's still alive, and it's been years now. But it really never thrived, and I didn't want that to happen to my magnolia tree. But the magnolia tree is very dense, and it's very tall. And we've been in this house for over 45 years, and it was already here. So it's got to be over 50 years old.
Well, like I said, those things show up, but they don't touch the tree. They're simply hanging on there as a place to grow. They don't penetrate into the tree. They don't steal anything from the tree. They just hang on. It's kind of like a bird building a nest in the tree.
Okay.
Just holding up the nest. It's just holding up that piece of moss.
Okay.
You can take them out if you like. That won't hurt anything.
It's always an indicator that
make it happy.
All right. Thank you so much, Jeff. I appreciate all your information, and I enjoy your show very much.
Thank you, ma'am, and thank you for the call. Folks, these Tillandsias, that's what they are. They are not harming the plant, but they are letting you know that the plant's not happy. Let's go to, this is Carl. Good morning, Carl. What can I help you with?
Good morning. Hope you're feeling better.
What can I help you with this morning? Yes, sir. What can I help you with this morning?
I heard a conversation last week about water systems. We have a water system that's salt based, and some of the hose, only one hose does not go through filtered water. All the other hoses go through filtered water. And my question is, which is better, just the city water that has chlorine in it, or the filtered water through salt that takes out the chlorine?
Okay. City water doesn't have chlorine in it anymore. All of the systems have changed over to a derivative called chloramine. The reason for that is chloramine is more effective and it lasts longer. So we actually get cleaner water out of it. The problem is that chloramine is intended to kill bacteria and stuff in your water, so we don't get it in us. That's a good thing. That water goes into the soil. It still has some reactivity with the biology that's in the soil. Now, it can usually easily be overcome because you just keep healthy soil going. You avoid the chemicals. You keep the lawn nice and healthy. Salt, on the other hand, high levels of salt do the exact same kind of damage. They will kill that soil biology because the high salt in the soil winds up being sucked into the bacteria or the fungus, and they're not used to it. It's kind of like putting a freshwater fish in the ocean. They're not going to make it. So, which is worse? Well, the fact of the matter is your plants need water. So if you only have one or the other, there's not a debate here. They got to have water. It's the water you have available to them. From a chemistry perspective, salt hangs around a lot longer. So high salt tends to build up in the soil. On the chlorine or chloramine side, it takes a while, but it at least finally breaks down. So the salt is a long-term, continuous, cumulative bad effect. The chlorine tends to be, gee, it would be nice if it wasn't there, but it doesn't build up and it doesn't last as long. But the short story is, if it's the only water you got, it's the only water you got, and plant needs water. Does that, that help answer that, Carl?
It does. But what there are things I can do about it. I certainly can turn off the water filtration system or come back and have it re-engineered so that it doesn't affect anything outside, only the water that's used inside that. So, yes, that answers my question. I will stop anything that's providing.
Yeah, great question, Carl. And it is something, if you can change that, would be great. Folks, we're at the bottom of the hour, and we have to break for the news. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. I want to talk about the last caller. The issue about salt or chlorine is a very good one. So let's focus on one thing. If it's your only source of water, you got to have water. It would be great if the water was free of chlorine and it was free of salt. But not everybody's is. Because if we're using public drinking water, you know what? We really like to have clean public drinking water. But of the two, salt accumulates in the soil over time. Not only does it kill the soil biology, it kills the structure of the soil, and it can turn it to what's called a sodic soil. It turns into a very hard substance. It's difficult to work with and very hard for plants to grow in. And you will start seeing that certain plants can't tolerate the soil salt. So it's a quick way to kill a soil. This happens a lot when the groundwater suddenly becomes contaminated with ocean water, high salt water, or when we pump the soil dry. The growing areas can really be hammered by this. It would be great if you had clean water that didn't have either one of these in it. And you can do that with rainwater. But if you have a choice, chlorine is less damaging long-term than a high salt water is. So that's something you can consider. And like Carl suggested, he's going to put a different tap in so that the water he uses outside will not be treated. But you got to have water. If it's what you got, it's what you got. Having water is the priority. Let's go to the phone. This is Sam. Good morning, Sam. What can I help you with?
Yes, I want to plant some trees, and I'm on the east side of I-35, so I have that thick black clay.
Yes, sir.
And I want trees that are low maintenance, meaning not a lot of water. So what are good choices?
Okay, well, there is no tree that you can plant that you can walk away from after you plant it. You're going to need to care for it for a couple of years, and that may mean, depending on the weather, a good deep soaking once a week for those couple of years until the tree establishes. Once established, that's something that we're never very clear about. When we call a plant drought tolerant, we have to include the words once established. So trees that are able to handle our environment well, once established, many of the oaks, chinquapin, Monterey, and bur oak, all three of those are oak wilt resistant, and they can handle the clay that you're in. And once established, they do not require a great deal of care in terms of being provided water. So long as you spend those first couple of years getting them established. The cedar elm is a great native Texas tree. Whether you get just the cedar elm or the lace bark elm, they are also drought tolerant, but they need a couple of years of good solid growth and care. And once they get established, those are ones that don't require much attention. And a beautiful one is the Arizona cypress, sometimes called an Arizona blue cypress. It's got a gorgeous color to it. It's highly drought tolerant once you get it established. And it may be actually more forgiving of that first couple of years of care than all the others that I've named. It is really a super strong tree here. But again, if you're looking at putting the tree in and walking away, I can't think of a single one that you can guarantee will survive. You have to get it that first couple of years of pretty decent care to get it established.
Okay. I know the mountain laurel likes the limestone soil. Does it do okay in clay also?
Not too bad. It is possible if we have a particularly long stretch of wet weather, it can be an issue not getting it to dry out. So if you have a clay soil, but you were planting the mountain laurel like near the top side of a slope so that you were really getting every advantage of draining downhill, that would probably be a safer place for it. It would normally be a plant that you would never provide supplemental water to. However, sitting in clay and a wet year where the clay never had an opportunity to dry out, probably would make it look poorly, but it should recover from that. Really take advantage of every trick in the book that you can, like plant it on the high side of a ridge or a slight slope so that the drainage would be there. And yeah, it should be able to manage in that environment.
Okay, and once the trees are planted, what's the best thing to do for them over the fall, winter, and spring before they start budding out?
Make sure that they're getting water. We sometimes get tricked in the cooler weather to think that, oh, the plants aren't demanding water. Those roots need to grow. Once a month, you can mix up a 5-gallon or 10-gallon bucket's worth of a seaweed solution. Simply follow the instructions on the bottle of seaweed and drench the roots of those freshly established plants. Occasionally, same idea, a little super thrive. And as spring rolls on, make sure that they're well mulched. Mulch really helps keep that soil moisture even and consistent in hot weather, and it keeps the root zone cooler. That'll help the tree really set its roots a lot faster. So those kind of simple things during this nice weather means you're not going to have so much stress during the super hot weather.
Great. Thank you for your help, Jeff. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thanks for the call. Let's go to, this is Sue. Good morning, Sue. What can I help you with?
Good morning. I went out to my garden this morning and I have a beautiful orange flowers on my squash plants, but there's all these little ants crawling in and out of them. And I just wonder what would be the most organic way to treat those?
Well, the most organic way would be to do nothing. They're not harming the plant. And while we would never normally think of ant as pollinator, the fact that they walk through the pollen and onto other flowers, they do have the ability to carry some pollen with them. Unless you see them actually carrying off pieces of the leaf, those would be leaf cutter ants, or you see them really covering a leaf, there would be the question that they're protecting another insect that's causing damage. The ants itself are not necessarily something that I have to run out there and treat immediately. Now, to answer your question, you can never put anything inside the blossom. That gets to be a trouble point because other bees and et cetera may come in there and they'll get it. If you think they're fire ants, and please don't stick your finger out there just to let them bite them to make sure because it's not worth the trouble. There is a product called Come and Get It. It's a safe bait that the fire ants will eat, take down to the queen, and slowly kill an entire mound. And you can use it in your food garden. So it is very safe to use around your veggies. And that won't work overnight, but it will start eliminating those ants and getting rid of them if they're fire ants. If they're not fire ants, you may not have success because the ant has to take up the bait. And not all ants are bait ants. They won't come and get the bait from something and eat it. But the come and get it is super safe to use in your garden to get those ants gone. Otherwise, unless you actually see them causing you a problem, like I said, tearing away a piece of the plant, they may not be worth the trouble of trying to treat them.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for the call, Sue. I appreciate it. Yeah, folks, they don't fall on the top of the list, but ants can be a pollinator. They're walking around in the flower means they're moving the pollen around, and that's what we want. Just because they're in there doesn't mean they're doing damage. But it also should be a case of let's look around. Aphids are protected by ants because the aphids give off a substance the ants want. So ants will chase away the predators that might eat aphids. So if you see a leaf and there's a lot of ants on it, look on the underside. See if you see any little bugs on it because the ants may be protecting them. And if that's happening, then yes, we want to address that problem. Folks, this is Gardening Naturally. You can give me a call. The number's 512-836-0590. We're going to take a quick break. Welcome back, everybody. Let's go here. Wow, whole bunch of numbers here. Let's go to David. Good morning, David. What can I help you with?
Oh, good morning. Yeah, I heard you talking about whether to use chlorinated water or other sources of water. And I'm just wondering, I've heard for years that if you take your garden hose water, probably got chlorine in it, and you fill up a rain barrel and then just let it sit for, 3 or 4 days, that for the most part the chlorine will evaporate out of it. And is 3 or 4 days about right, or is it more than that or less?
Actually, we don't use chlorine anymore. The public water supplies, especially the ones here in Texas, use a product called chloramine, and it doesn't evaporate. So
Could
let it sit for days, and it would still be in the water system. So there are ways to remove it. You could go to a pet store and you can get that little bottle of product where when you fill your fish tank, you put a drop of it in there so that it gets rid of all the chlorine. Well, it also gets rid of chloramine. Is that cost effective? I don't know. But use that product to get the chloramine out. I don't know how much per gallon or how many gallons, a small bottle would treat. And it's also known that ascorbic acid, also known as vitamin C, can break down the chloramine. It's something like 1,000 milligrams to 50 gallons of water. So if you had a 50-gallon barrel and you filled it with city water and then dropped in a 1,000-milligram vitamin C, pure vitamin C, the ascorbic acid powder, that should break down all the chloramine too. But we're still stuck with the equation of, you got to have water, regardless of what kind it is. And the convenience of I use more than 50 gallons of water pretty easily just to maintain everything that I would need to in moderate temperatures, yet alone in the summer. So it's a practical matter of trying to clear that off of all your water. You can purchase filters that are supposed to attach to your garden hose and will filter out chlorine and chloramine. But then we're back to the cost equation. How many gallons of water do you use? How much is the filter? How many times would you have to replace it? A good, healthy soil, full of biology, well-tended, plenty of organic matter, will handle the problem without you having to do anything. But if you wish to take that extra step, there are methods to do so.
Yeah, that it's funny you mentioned that it's only 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C would break it out. If I remember right, Costco's got, you can get 1,000 1,000s for about $20, you know, vitamin C. I take it you'd probably have to, like, break it up, like in a mortar and pestle, and then sprinkle it in there? You wouldn't just drop a single pellet in there and hope that it'll dissolve.
Well, you would assume that it would, because that's how we take it. It would just be a matter of getting it into the water. You can also buy ascorbic acid as a powder in bulk. For example, here in Austin, Austin Homebrew sells it. It's a component of beer brewing.
Right.
To help cleans the water. You can use it for various things. So you can buy it in bulk, and it would be inexpensive. But again, it's the, do I want or need to go to that level? And even if it was inexpensive, is the effort worth it considering how much water I may need to use?
Sure, yeah, and yes. It's based, I mean, I used to live out in western Colorado where it hardly ever rained, and, you know, you pretty much had to use ditch water for, you know, for your irrigation, and so it was, you know, a matter of trying to, but the chloramine, that's interesting. Have they been using that for long? Is that, I wasn't aware that chloride it per se was gone, but the chloramine is what you called it, right?
Right, and here's the reason why. Chlorine, when it does its job, one of the byproducts of killing the bad guys is to produce trihalomethanes, which are bad components in water. They're possible carcinogens. So what happened is we got the nasty biology out of water, but we wound up with these possible carcinogens in the water.
Great.
Chloramine does not produce that byproduct. And it's been, depending on the water system, it's been a decade or more that public water supplies have started to convert over. So that, because controlling the trihalomethanes is a requirement, and it's difficult and expensive to do, and the chloramine solved the problem. So let's see here. Next, David, sorry, it sounds like you dropped off. Let's go to, this is Forrest. Good morning, Forrest. What can I help you with?
Good morning, Jeff. Although I don't encourage whole house water softeners, if you're stuck with one, there is a situation they're always put in where you can bypass them. Incoming water doesn't go through the salt. And if you bypassed it before you went out and watered your lawn or this or that, you get a few gallons of treated water before the untreated water comes out, and so you've diluted it a whole bunch. So that would be, and you put it back in service when you're through watering your lawns and stuff like that. So that would minimize the amount of softened water and also save you salt for not trying to soften water that you're using to sprinkle your lawn with.
That's true. And, you know, a lot of house designs, when they're building, they try to put in a unsoftened tap because of that reason. They recognize that if you're using this in your backyard, it really doesn't need to be softened. It's a waste of money. Older homes have that.
So it's upstream of your water softener then.
Right.
You're putting
I happen to have that
faucet. Yeah.
Right. I happen to have the previous owner tapped way up front, just on the other side of the meter, and I have a completely separate run that is all my outside water. So it totally does bypass the water softener. But you bring up a great point. The bypass is not difficult to use. It's on every water softener so that you can do maintenance on it without having to unplumb the whole house.
Yeah.
And it only takes a second. You could push that button so that you're on bypass and go out and do all of your watering and things like that. And when you come back in the house, hit the button again. Very convenient, saves you salt, and you would wind up with less salt issue in the water you're using in the landscape.
Yeah, a whole lot less.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's a good idea, Forrest. A really good idea. Thanks for the call. Yeah, folks, don't Don't get wrapped up. Don't get wrapped up. Your plants need water. If that's the water you have, that's the water you have. The issue with whether there's chloramine in there or softened water salt in there, you can have your water tested. And you can see how much salt is in there. And then you can go to your public water supply company, whether it's a city or one of the water supply companies. I have one of those. They're required by law to produce a document that shows you what's in the water when they test it. And you can see what your water test looks like compared to what the public water supply, and you can see how much salt am I really adding? Is it a lot? How much chloramine is added to the water that I'm having to deal with? You're going to find that in terms of your landscape and your lawn, you probably don't need to worry about it. Folks, this is Gardening Naturally. Coming up on a break for the news at the top of the hour. We'll be back on the other side.